Ladies and gentlemen, this is Steve Oz. You're on the Eyes is Watching channel. Prepare to have your minds blown as we expose the scandalous theory that gangster rap was deliberately funded and promoted by the CIA to dismantle certain communities and boost prison populations. It all starts with an alleged meeting within the music industry that reshaped the landscape of hip-hop as we know it. But we'll go even deeper than that, okay? We gotta uncover the CIA's alleged ties to drug smuggling and the creation of crack cocaine, which ravaged many communities across America. The laundry list of corruption within the CIA is endless, but can you believe it though? Intelligence agencies tangled in corruption? Shocking, right? Yet this corruption spans decades, revealing a web of deceit and manipulation that will leave you questioning everything you thought you knew about the music industry. Now, it's quite obvious that the themes in hip hop changed drastically from the 80s to 90s. Was the CIA involved? Were there conspiracies to infiltrate the art form to switch the mainstream hip-hop vibes from political and socially conscious to that of degeneracy and criminality? Now, it all starts with this alleged meeting that reshaped the rap scene and left a generation in ruins, titled The Secret Meeting That Changed Rap Music and Destroyed a Generation. This letter, penned by an anonymous industry insider, exposes the dark underbelly of the music business. Originally shared on the blog site Hip Hop Is Red, the letter comes from a self-proclaimed decision maker at a major record label. Now, there are many questions as to who is behind this letter and is this letter legit? I mean, the person behind the letter goes by the name of John Smith. So make of this what you will. But while you may dismiss this as just another conspiracy theory, keep in mind many judges have been convicted for similar schemes outlined in this very letter. Strap in, peeps, as we dive into the dark world of the music industry, the entertainment business, and their involvement with the CIA, giant entities working together to pull off an agenda that benefits only those in charge. Now, the talks of the CIA's involvement in promoting gangster rap to create a devastating cultural shift has been exploding lately. I mean, a video was circulating of Crazy Bone from Bone Thugs and Harmony reading this letter about the secret meeting that changed rap forever. People start to ask questions like, what if rap music is just a tool to turn impressionable listeners into prison-bound degenerates? And based on the evolution of rap music from the 80s to now, it's not hard to see that taking place. But the validity of this letter itself is questionable. The first place it was seen was on a blog site called Hip Hop Is Red, written by an anonymous man named John Smith. With the description, this anonymous letter landed in my inbox about a minute ago. I mean, highly questionable, I must say, but this meeting allegedly took place in 1991. Did the establishment force gangster rap into the eyes of the public right after this meeting took place? Well, let's look at the top Billboard hits starting in 1988. The reason why I picked this date is because there were some gangster rap albums out there, such as Straight Outta Compton by NWA. A few others like Ice-T, Too Short, and Kool G Rap were all out at this time as well, but their music wasn't hitting the top Billboard 100 singles. In 1988, here were the only rap songs on the top 100 list of Billboard hits. Now, I wouldn't consider any of these rap songs here gangster rap, okay? Parents Just Don't Understand by DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, Will Smith, was the highest one up there, hitting number 12 on the Billboard charts in 1988. In 1989, here were the top rap songs on the Billboard charts. Notice anything? Once again, nothing we can consider gangster rap per se on here. Even the NWA song that did make it here was arguably the only conscious rap that NWA put out. It was called Express Yourself, with lyrics from Dr. Dre like, I still express, yo, I don't smoke weed or cess, cause it's known to give a brother brain damage. And brain damage on the mic don't manage nothing but making a sucker and you equal. That's right, people, the ones with the most attitude were saying weed gives you brain damage. Oh, have times changed. Now we got lyrics promoting Percocets, lean, Oxycontin. I mean, it's like these rappers are drug pushers, and I mean drug pushers for Big Pharma. But let's carry on here. 1990, once again, no gangster rap. as you can see here. But 1991, apparently when this alleged meeting took place, here were the rap songs on the Billboard charts right here. As you can see, it's not showing any gangster rap again. Summertime by Will Smith hit number 4 on the Billboards, which was huge for back then. Shout out to Will Smith because the Fresh Prince was killing it back in those days. Now, 1992, a year after this alleged meeting took place, this is when we saw a change happen. We spot Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg's Undercover on the Billboard 100 list. Now, this song arguably was considered one of the earliest and most influential gangster rap songs to achieve significant commercial success. Now, from the information I've gathered, it could very well be the first gangster rap song to hit the Billboard charts. And based on this, it seems to give credibility to the original letter about the secret meeting that allegedly took place in 1991, because just 1 year after this said meeting, we saw gangster rap officially hit the mainstream. Now, in 1993, things really started to change. A lot more gangster rap was now hitting the Billboard charts, as you can see here. Nothing But a G Thing by Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg, Regulate by Warren G featuring Nate Dogg, Insane in the Brain by Cypress Hill, Dre Day by Dr. Dre featuring Snoop Dogg once again. I mean, Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg were taking over in the early 90s, as you can see here. So things started to change in the years 1992 and 1993. Gangster rap was exploding. This genre of rap was undoubtedly taken over, and it seems like Suge Knight's label Death Row was the primary pushers of this music when it comes to mainstream success of gangster rap, in quotes. Now back to this alleged letter here about the CIA's involvement. Now this is what the self-proclaimed decision maker in hip-hop said about the shady music exec that invited him to the meeting. He told us that since our employers had become silent investors in this prison business, it was now in their interest to make sure that these prisons remain filled. Our job would be to help make this happen by marketing music which promotes criminal behavior, rap being the music of choice. He assured us that this would be a great situation for us because rap music was becoming an increasingly profitable market for our companies. And as employees, we'd also be able to buy personal stocks in these prisons. Now, apparently, the ones behind the funding of gangster rap also held stock in the prison system. And here's an excerpt off of Davey D's Hip Hop Corner. It says right here, last year, Corrections Corporation of America, CCA, the biggest name in the private prison industry, contacted 48 states offering to buy their prisons. One stipulation of eligibility for the deal was particularly bizarre, an assurance by the agency partner that the agency has sufficient inmate population to maintain a minimum 90% occupancy rate over the term of the contract. What kind of legitimate and ethical measures could possibly be taken to ensure the maintenance of a 90% prison occupancy rate? 2 months later, an anonymous email was sent out to various members of the music and publishing industries giving an account of a meeting where it was determined that hip-hop music would be manipulated to drive up privatized prison profits. Its author, despite claiming to be a former industry insider, did not provide the names of anyone involved in the plot, nor did he specify by which company he himself was employed to. As such, the letter was largely regarded as a fraud for lack of facts. And looking into the details and analyzing the data surrounding this secret meeting and this letter from a random hip-hop blog site, it does seem questionable. Now, to say that gangster rap was created or funded by the CIA to pack the prisons so that the ones buying prison stocks can make more money, if you say this, you would also have to make the argument that Suge Knight was involved with the CIA in bringing gangster rap to the mainstream. And as far as I know, Suge ain't hold no damn stocks in the prison system. But who knows? Because if we find out he did, well, that would be a bombshell revelation that would shake the hip-hop world. Can you imagine? The only money Suge had in the prison system is when he bailed out his homeboys that was locked up, such as Tupac, for $1.4 million to be precise. Now, that's a lot of money for back then. But did the commercial success of gangster rap lead to an increase in the incarceration rates in the states? Keep in mind, when this alleged meeting took place, along with when the first gangster rap songs hit the billboards, around 1991 and 1992. Now let's look at incarceration rates and high school dropout rates to see if we can find find a correlation here. Take a look at this graph showing the rise in mass incarceration from years 1970 to the peak of the U.S. prison population, which was in the year 2009. You notice anything here? There was a steady trajectory of incarceration rates starting in the early 1980s, and this trajectory has been staying consistent. In 1985, the U.S. prison population was around 500,000 people. Now, this kept rising drastically year by year. There was no significant impact on the prison populations after gangster rap hit the billboards. By analyzing this data, we see that there was a steady increase in incarceration rates at least a decade earlier. Now, what could have been the cause of this? Now, I grew up listening to NWA. Eazy-E was like a superhero to me growing up. I had all the CDs. Nobody could tell me I wasn't Eazy-E, okay? Matter of fact, here's a pic of me at 11 years old rocking my NWA hat. I knew every NWA song, okay? And Eazy-E song by heart. Could recite Eazy-E's lyrics for days. Now, one CD I had of Eazy-E came with a DVD that included behind-the-scenes footage, rare videos of Eazy-E, and even a documentary about his life. It was called The Impact of a Legend Set. One part of the documentary stood out to me. It was a part where Jerry Heller, the man that co-founded Ruthless Records, spoke about first meeting Eazy-E and hearing his songs. Now, keep in mind, before this meeting with Eazy-E, Jerry Heller had a record label called Ruthless International, which was a management and publishing company that represented artists such as the World Class Wrecking Crew, which included Dr. Dre and a group called CIA, which included Ice Cube. That's interesting, right? What are the chances? One of the first gangster rappers ever was in a group called CIA. I'm sure it's just a coincidence, though. But this is how Jerry Heller got into contact with Eazy-E, because he was friends with Dr. Dre, because Dr. Dre was in the World Class Wrecking Crew. This is what Jerry Heller said when he first heard Eazy-E's record, Boys in the Hood.
We really just thought we were blowing up when we went on tour and the contracts came about.
I had been involved with a couple of the early rap records that had success. I was managing a group called the World Class Wrecking Crew through a guy named Alonzo Williams. So that's how I met Eazy. He played me a couple of tracks, played me a track called Boys in the Hood, which I thought was probably the most important record that I had heard since the beginning of rock and roll.
Now, that was Jerry Heller right there, a Jewish individual that was head of a record label. I know, an anomaly, right? And he was arguably behind the blowing up of this gangster rap. They call Eazy-E the godfather of gangster rap. Well, Jerry Heller was the don of gangster rap then. He said Boys in the Hood, which was a straight up gangster rap track all the way through with crime-filled lyrics of carjackings and shootings, etc., that was the most important record he heard since the beginning of rock and roll. Now, why is this? Well, here's Alonzo Williams, former member of the World Class Wrecking Crew, saying this about NWA songs.
Eazy and NWA dropped their first record. The music business, the streets had changed dramatically, okay? The streets had went from being cool to being very hostile and very violent. And Eazy them created the soundtrack for the streets.
Everything you hear on our records is true.
Now, keep in mind, Alonzo Williams, that man was in the World Class Wrecking Crew. He said Ice Cube, Dr. Dre, MC Ren, none of these guys were gangsters in the streets actually living these lyrics. So he was shocked. He even said this when he first heard them talking this gangster rap.
Now, what about Ice Cube?
Ice Cube was a great kid, just a nice kid.
So Ice Cube wasn't gangbanging at all?
No.
Was it a little weird hearing about all this gangbanging stuff from someone that doesn't gangbang at all?
Fuck me up.
Yeah?
Who? I'm like, you like, got to be bullshit.
Like, so I was like, gangster. Like, I thought Ice Cube was the most gangster on the planet.
You know what?
I thought Ice Cube come in here and kill everybody. You know what I mean?
He's a great actor. I have limited knowledge of Eazy's drug distribution. He did a little something. But he wasn't like he was Nino Brown.
Okay.
He wasn't Scarface and no shit. He may have moved some ounces or maybe a half a bird or something like that.
But apparently Eazy-E was the only one that was in the streets and hustling. He was selling his drugs or whatever. But even Eazy-E wasn't a major gangbanging type of figure. So it's interesting that one of the first gangster rap crews weren't gangsters. And it was all an image. Now, there are a few ways to interpret what Alonzo Williams said about how when this music was put out, the streets went from being cool to being very hostile and violent, because he wasn't very clear on what he was saying. He either meant that the streets went from being cool to violent and hostile for other factors such as socioeconomics and poverty or whatnot, and NWA was just talking about their experiences in the hood, a art imitates life type of scenario. Or he meant the streets were cool, people were getting along with each other until NWA's first album, Straight Outta Compton, dropped. Then a bloodbath ensued in the streets. So you can make an argument that life imitates art here. Now here's where things get really weird. After Eazy-E's success in this gangster rap genre, they started calling him the godfather of gangster rap. Eazy-E was invited to a lunch with George H.W. Bush. Says right here, on a 1991 NBC News report. It says this, Eazy-E received a fundraising letter from Texas Senator Bill Graham inviting him to join the elite inner circle. You heard that right, people. Secret society trying to keep their eye on me. And this was set up by label head Jerry Heller. Surprise, surprise. Check this out right here. It's interesting, right? A lot of headlines with this. But is there an argument that when gangster rap hit the mainstream charts, this resulted in higher incarceration rates? Not exactly, according to this data right here, as you can see in this graph. It started increasing in the early 1980s, but did the commercial success of gangster rap lead to a higher dropout rate when it comes to black and brown people in America? According to the graphs here, it shows this. The percentage of high school dropouts ages 16 to 24 has decreased since 1970. The percentage of white students who have dropped out of high school has declined from 13% to 5.8%. The percentage of black student dropouts has decreased from 27.9% to 10.7%. Hispanic dropouts have declined as well from 35.2% in 1980 to 22.1% in 2006. So apparently after this secret meeting took place to push gangster rap into the mainstream to create prison-bound degenerates took place in 1991, the black dropout rate decreased from 19% in the early 1980s to 12% by 1995. So clearly, as this data shows us, there was no correlation between the promotion of gangster rap and incarceration rates or high school dropout rates. But what we do know is after this meeting, Tupac did get a Thug Life tat on his belly a year later and decided to make being a thug his entire image. But that could be because he became obsessed with his role in Juice, so he just wanted to live out his Bishop character in real life. I don't know. But what happened in the early 1980s that caused an explosion in incarceration rates in the states? Refer back to this graph right here, as you can see. Well, it looks like it was a combination of factors here. The crack epidemic that hit the states in the early 1980s, alongside the war on drugs, the term popularized by Richard Nixon in the 1970s, which Ronald Reagan took and significantly escalated the rhetoric and policies associated with the war on drugs in the 1980s. Ronald Reagan declared drug abuse to be public enemy number one in a speech in 1982. And here is what follows. After the speech, the implementation of stringent anti-drug policies such as mandatory minimum sentences and harsher penalties for drug offenses. This led to a significant increase in arrests and convictions for drug-related crimes. Tough-on-crime legislation in the 1980s played a major part in mass incarceration as well. The enactment of tough-on-crime laws at both federal and state levels, including measures like the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986 and the Comprehensive Crime Control Act of 1984. These laws resulted in longer sentences for offenders and contributed to overcrowding in prisons. In addition, the adoption of sentencing policies such as three-strike laws and mandatory minimum sentences for certain offenders offenses led to more individuals being sentenced to prison for longer periods, particularly for nonviolent crimes. So in the early 80s, when crack was first introduced, the war on drugs escalated at the same time. Incarceration rates shot sky high. Later in that decade, gangster rap started to blow up. So it could be a combination of these factors that led to packed prisons. First destroying communities with drugs, then promoting gangster rap and glamorizing drug dealing to add in elements of violence as well to escalate all of the chaos. I mean, who knows? From the crack epidemic to gangster rap, it's not far-fetched to believe there was CIA involvement in both. In 1996, the San Jose Mercury News published a series of articles alleging that the CIA's Contra Army had a role in fueling the crack cocaine epidemic in Los Angeles during the 1980s. Reporter Gary Webb's investigation claimed that the CIA financed its covert war against Nicaragua's leftist government by selling cut-rate cocaine to South Central LA drug dealer Ricky Ross. This sparked widespread outrage and demands for official inquiries, particularly from the black community. The series provided a crucial link between the CIA, the Contras, and the distribution of crack cocaine in black neighborhoods. While major media outlets and CIA director John Deutsch denied these claims, citing lack of evidence and disputing the alleged connections, the Mercury News stood by its reporting. Evidence suggested CIA complicity, including reports of CIA-supplied planes transporting cocaine and lenient treatment of known drug traffickers with alleged ties to the agency. Despite opposition and attempts to discredit the allegations, the controversy raised serious questions about the CIA's involvement in drug trafficking and its impact on vulnerable communities. If the CIA was involved in the distribution of crack in certain communities and the promotion of gangster rap, I mean, it would make sense. From BlackRock to Vanguard, two of the largest investment management companies in the world, may hold shares in companies that own or operate media organizations. These media companies could include conglomerates that own television networks, film studios, publishing houses, newspapers, and all digital media platforms. And keep in mind, BlackRock and Vanguard have faced scrutiny and criticism in the past for their investments in private prison companies as well. Activists and advocacy groups have raised concerns about the ethical implications of investing in companies that profit from incarceration, particularly given issues such as mass incarceration and concerns about the treatment of prisoners. Clearly, we have a serious ethical issue here of these major entities having their tentacles dipped into so many different influential positions here. They control the media, control the record labels, at the same time hold stocks in prisons. So they're promoting a certain kind of music out there, and if you end up in prison for it, they get paid. So they get paid all these different ways. But at the end of the day, it's all about choice. Remember, there's a lot of manipulation out here from left to right. Anywhere you look, mainstream media is promoting certain things, a lot of degeneracy. But at the end of the day, personal responsibility and accountability matters most. Their propaganda can't work on you if you are in the right state mentally. And now we got Meek Mill tweeting, "I watch Candace Owens all the time too." So we're seeing a change here. We're seeing a change in the collective narrative of hip hop. Candace Owens responds with, "I can't figure it out, but the Black American awakening seems to me to be the biggest threat that the American media wants to prevent. They want our families destroyed, and they write articles feverishly to prevent Black hip-hop artists from going anywhere near Black conservative thinkers who know the truth about how music is being used to harm our communities. There has been a demonic intention to destroy Black America and an infiltration in what used to be good music. It is time for all of us to come together and recognize this." So it seems like a lot of rappers now are starting to realize that there is a huge influence that their music is putting out. Remember when Tupac said this at the end of White Man's World? "Use your brain. It ain't them that's killing us, it's us that's killing us. It ain't them that's knocking us off, it's us that's knocking us off.
telling you, better watch it. Or be a victim.
It's not them that's killing us, it's us that's killing us. Ooh boy, if he said that now, he'd be called an Uncle Tom and a sellout. And I'll even make the argument that if Tupac lived long enough, he would be a conservative, speaking alongside Candace Owens and Larry Elder. But was gangster rap forced on the people against their will? Or are those in charge just providing the masses with what they desire? Look at action movies like John Wick, where the main character is blasting dudes left and right. I try to count how many people he killed in that movie, and I'm sure it's in the hundreds. People love that movie. Or other iconic films like Scarface, where a Cuban immigrant takes over Miami's drug trade and ends up being a drug kingpin and eliminating his rivals ruthlessly. I know you remember the big scene. Say hello to my little friend. I mean, who didn't want to be Scarface after that movie, okay? Why are these scenes of violence so captivating to us? This prompts a deeper exploration of human psychology. Why are we inherently drawn to such themes? The fascination with violence and suffering extends throughout history, from the Roman Colosseum's gladiators to modern-day entertainment in violent action flicks. Back in the days of the Colosseum, they had gladiators fight to the death and even face multiple lions at the same time for people's entertainment. People sat back watching in delight as lions mauled men to death and tore them from limb to limb. Audiences cheered. Why did these crowds eagerly gather to witness men battling to the death or facing ferocious animals alone, knowing it would be a bloodbath? It seems that humans possess an innate inclination towards violence and negativity as forms of entertainment. This predisposition raises profound questions about the nature of humanity and our collective fascination with the darker aspects of human behavior. Let's get into the reasons why this could be the case. From the evolution side, some scholars suggest that humans have an evolutionary predisposition towards violence due to our ancestors' survival instincts. A long time ago, violence was necessary for hunting, defending territories, and resolving conflicts. This could be why exposure to violent stimuli could trigger primal instincts and adrenaline responses in us, leading to heightened arousal and engagement. Another reason could be that watching violent movies or even listening to violent music may provide a cathartic release for pent-up emotions and frustrations. We become addicted to experiencing these intense emotions through these fictional characters. This could temporarily alleviate stress and tension for us. On top of that, watching John Wick just offing dudes for killing his dog triggers something in us, you know, because witnessing justice being served or conflicts resolved through violent means can evoke a sense of satisfaction or closure for viewers. And this satisfaction could change from person to person. Some individuals are inherently drawn to thrilling or high-stakes experiences, including those involving risk, danger, or excitement. Watching violence in entertainment may satisfy the psychological need for stimulation and arousal, giving us an adrenaline rush, a sense of exhilaration. But what makes music a little different is because movies, we all agree, are not real. But these rappers that promote this gangster rap lifestyle claim that it's not just lyrics, that they are the real deal, that they really live this. So outside of music, they're doing interviews saying that this is real. This is their real life. They're the realists. They're the biggest gangsters the world has ever seen. And kids that grow up idolizing these individuals listen to their interviews and say, I want to be just like him. He even says it's not just music. He lives that life. And since these gangster rappers are the epitome of cool in a lot of the younger generation's eyes, they grow up to try to emulate what they see. Now, there are many other factors here as to why we are stimulated by these graphic scenes or explicit lyrics, such as being overly exposed to these kinds of things when you're young, so you just become normalized to it. Exposure to violence in music or film from a young age can desensitize individuals and normalize violent behavior as a form of entertainment. And lastly, many use music, films, or even video games as escapism and fantasy. Entertainment allows individuals to escape from their everyday realities and immerse themselves in fictional worlds where they can experience excitement, adventure, and feel a sense of danger. Some people are just attracted to violent entertainment because it allows them time to explore forbidden or taboo topics in a safe environment. We live in a relatively safe world compared to our ancient ancestors, so many of us satisfy our primal urges through these video games, films, or music. So are those in charge just giving us what we already secretly desire? Or is there a more nefarious reason for this? Let me know what you guys think in the comments. We do see a major shift in hip-hop from the 1980s to 1990s, transitioning from more politically conscious and socially aware themes to more of a focus on gangsterism and the glamorization of street life. This wouldn't be the first time the CIA infiltrated movements they thought were a threat to national security. For instance, in the 1960s, the CIA allegedly infiltrated the hippie movement for this very reason. The hippie movement in the 1960s was a threat to the U.S. because they challenged the official establishment narrative. They protested against the Vietnam War, making it harder for the government to keep support for the war. They were also bringing about a new way of thinking, a mindset which wasn't focused on money or material possessions, which was against normal consumer culture. And this is why some allegations suggest that the CIA monitored and infiltrated various activist groups, including anti-war organizations, civil rights groups, and countercultural movements like the hippie movement. The agency reportedly gathered intelligence on individuals and organizations deemed subversive or potentially threatening to national security, and then they would run disinformation campaigns against them. This allegedly involved spreading false information, rumors, and conspiracy theories to undermine the credibility and effectiveness of activists and their causes. You heard that right, people. The same CIA that coined the phrase conspiracy theories would spread conspiracy theories themselves on groups they deemed to be a threat to national security. Makes you wonder, huh? On top of that, there are some claims that the CIA conducted experiments with psychedelic drugs such as LSD as part of its MKUltra program. Some theories suggest that the CIA distributed LSD within the hippie community purposely as a means of social control or experimentation. Some allege that the CIA used informants or agents within the hippie community to distribute LSD to influential figures or gatherings associated with the counterculture movement. And through the MKUltra program, the CIA was able to use LSD to control someone's thoughts and behavior. Allegedly, and this same method was used to infiltrate and manipulate the hippie movement from within, potentially influencing its direction and activities. After this, there was a serious negative public image that developed around them, and the hippie movement started to die out. So just like how they use LSD to destroy the hippie movement, I'm pretty sure they're using lean and oxycontin to destroy the public image of rap, and have these young impressionable minds use these drugs to be just like their favorite rapper because they consider them as the epitome of cool. Now, a very interesting book right here called The Rape of the Mind by Joost Mierlo, written in 1955, had an interesting paragraph I want to end this with. He writes, "The tragic facts of political experiences in our age make it all too clear that applied psychological techniques can brainwash entire nations and reduce their citizens to a kind of mindless robotism, which becomes for them a normal way of living." I'll let that one marinate with you. And that's where I'm going to leave it, folks. If you like what I do here, if you want to support this channel, make sure you like, you subscribe, and there are other ways to help support this channel. Everything you see here is done by me, so if you appreciate the effort that goes into this, links are in the description for ways to support. Until next time, peeps, this is Steve Eiser on the Eyes is Watching channel, signing off.